What struck me about the scheme itself was just how much this cried out for attention, according to the FCPA resource guide from the Justice Department, when it has its list of questions you should be thinking about with the third parties.
That was Matt Kelly. This is Tom Fox, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the award-winning Compliance Into the Weeds. In this episode, Matt and I take a deep dive into the Gunvor FCPA enforcement action. It was a massive enforcement action, some $661 million in fines and penalties, and a lot of lessons learned for the compliance professional. Matt and I take a deep dive, literally going into the weeds to explore his most recent, fascinating FCPA enforcement action. I know you'll enjoy this episode of Compliance Into the Weeds on the Compliance Podcast Network. First, we're going to have a word from our sponsor, Ethico.
Navigating the complexities of compliance data security and accessibility is a daunting task. Ethico makes it effortless with real-time permissions control. This feature ensures that sensitive information is both secure and accessible while balancing confidentiality with efficiency. It's about creating a fortress around your data while keeping the gates flexible for those who need access. Discover a solution where security meets agility. Step into a world of controlled freedom with Ethico. Learn about reshaping your data security at ethico.com/CPN. Book a demo, download our white paper by Tom Fox, The ROI of Compliance, and try our free ROI calculator to start a new chapter in ethics and compliance management.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, back again with Matt Kelly for another episode of the award-winning Compliance Into the Weeds. Welcome back, Matt.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
Well, Matt, I don't know if the paucity of FCPA enforcement actions from 2023 caused the first couple of months of this year to change, but we had another major FCPA case last with the Swiss trader Gunvor. What about this case caught your attention?
Well, Tom, I suppose the first thing that caught my attention was the money, because there was a lot of it that was involved here. There was a big criminal penalty. There was a big disgorgement. There was a lot of money that was being paid to some very shadowy and sketchy third parties. You know, we can go through the outline of the case, but in many ways, it is really not that different than what we have heard before. Gunvor is this Swiss energy commodity trading house, and one of its subsidiaries was working with some rather sketchy third parties, I'll call them that, intermediaries. They were fixers, two brothers called the Yakaza brothers. They were working with executives at Gunvor to bribe government officials in Ecuador, who were in charge of the state oil company, Petro Ecuador, down there. And this all happened in the 2010s, clear into, I think, 2020, where they established several shell companies, the brothers Yakaza, the third-party fixers. And then Gunvor proceeded to funnel $97 million through those shell companies. And some portion of that, I'm not clear on exactly how much, then became slush funds for bribes to the government officials at Petro Ecuador in exchange for basically fixing transport and marketing contracts for the state-owned oil at Petro Ecuador. That's what Gunvor was looking to do, was to corner the market on these deals, doing deals with Petro Ecuador to ship their oil around the world. Ultimately, this led to, let me make sure I have my numbers right because they are so big, $374 million criminal penalty, $287 million in disgorgement. And Tom, all of it totals up when you include some payments being made to Swiss regulators as well, $661 million that Gunvor is paying to settle these charges. So that is a lot of money.
Well, Matt, it was a lot of money, but was there anything in the bribery scheme that you thought was new or different? Or was this just bribery the old-fashioned way, using third parties as conduits or cutouts to get the bribe money to the decision makers at Petro Ecuador?
I mean, it seemed to me to be more the latter, that we have heard this before. They, the brothers Yakaza established two shell companies, one called EIC, one called OIC. And they established the shell companies in Panama. Okay, well, that's not a good thing because Panama is notorious for being a money laundering and corruption haven if you are reaching into Latin America. And they were just shoving huge amounts of money down there. What struck me about the scheme itself was just how much this cried out for attention, according to the FCPA resource guide from the Justice Department, when it has its list of questions you should be thinking about with the third parties. So does the compliance function understand the role and the need for the third party? Do the contract terms specifically describe the services to be performed? Are the payment terms clear? Are they comparable to payment terms in that industry, in that country? And are they actually documenting the work that they're doing? And then we go back to, like I said, Tom, the a lot of money, $97 million that went through these third parties and these shell companies. So do we really understand? Did anybody understand what is the need for a third party for $97 million? I know that they were charging or they were being paid certain success fees, but most of the compensation that went to the Akaza brothers were these volume fees per barrel. So the bigger the deal, the more money they were being paid. So there's like this incentive structure that, you know, it doesn't seem like it's very low risk to me. But ultimately, we have seen this sort of thing before on the scheme side. Now, I'll have other stuff I want to talk about on the settlement side, Tom, that was either interesting or confusing to me. But at least in my estimation, the scheme itself, like, I don't know. It seems kind of sort of like what we've heard before. What was your take on it?
Matt, I wholeheartedly agree with your analysis on the scheme, and you really touched on what I really wanted to get to, which was the resolution. And I have to say that I thought Gunvar got a superior resolution, but they did have some interesting, I think, guidelines for a FCPA compliance practitioner in settlement documents as to what Gunvar did. You want to maybe explore that in some detail?
They did a lot, according to the Justice Department. I can give you, I think the big thing is that they got rid of their third-party agents. They had been using people like the Akaza brothers, who, by the way, we should add, they were subsequently charged and pleaded out and convicted of their own personal FCPA violations. So was one Gunvor employee named Raymond Cohut. He was convicted, and one Petro Ecuador official. I suspect we may not have heard the end of the individual cases here. I don't know, but there are a not lot of other officials unidentified in the criminal complaint and statement of facts and whatnot. So maybe there's going to be more individuals who get implicated here. But anyways, back to Gunvor and what they did, they eliminated the use of third-party business or origination agents. And that was striking to me because, yet again, Tom, this is a big, deep structural change for the sales function at a large company. And we have seen that before in recent FCPA actions. This, I think, is at least the third time I've seen it by my count, that last year, Albemarle, they eliminated the use of third-party sales agents as part of their settlement. SAP eliminated the use of third-party sales commissions globally. And for their FCPA settlement that they announced, I think it was in January, and now here we have Gunvor saying that it will no longer be using third parties to help it originate new deals. So all of the fixers and brokers and whatnot, I guess they go over the side. Good, because those are notorious sources of FCPA risk. But it's the sort of thing that, you know, it strikes me you're not going to do that without the highest level of the organization saying, we need to do this, and sitting down with the rest of the enterprise and the sales function and the traders and whatnot to tell them, we're doing this for the sake of good corporate compliance. So there are many other things that they did, and we can get into those too. But Tom, I'll just stop right there for a moment, that it just seems to me that these big structural changes to the sales operation that cannot easily be undone, that seems to be a running theme of these fewer but bigger FCPA enforcement cases we are seeing from the Justice Department.
Well, it's certainly been the theme since at least Albemarle that the DOJ's made note of it. And I think we can probably both agree when they make such a big note of it that it's something that they are viewing with approval going forward. Albemarle really set the standard when they changed their entire sales model. So, but there were some other things in here as well that you noted in your blog post, which of course we'll link to in the show notes. You want to maybe help us go through these?
Sure. So there was a big list, and I'll go through some of the bullet points here. So Gunvor implemented a control framework for internal business developers, plus additional layers of review for counterparty payments. And I think that clearly originates from these huge amounts of money and payments that were going through the two shell companies and the Brothers Yakaza down in, they were in Miami, and the shell companies were based in Panama. By the way, some of the meetings to conspire on this scheme actually did happen on U.S. soil in Miami, too. So there's plenty of U.S. nexus here, even though Gunvor is a Swiss company and not traded. So there is no, or not publicly traded in the U.S. So there's no SEC enforcement action here. Gunvor enhanced the independent compliance committee it has with responsibility for reviewing high-risk transactions, updated their compensation policies to better incentivize compliance with the law. I would love to know exactly what those updates were and what their compensation schemes now look like. I think that would be fascinating. A lot of testing of the compliance program, including compliance culture reviews, testing third-party due diligence processes and payment controls, and also implementing a business communications policy that addresses the use of ephemeral messaging, which is interesting because ephemeral messaging is a sore point with the Justice Department. But under U.S. law, the ones who typically have the least flexibility on this are investment companies, registered advisors, broker-dealers, and whatnot. Not a trading firm like Gunvor, which is not U.S. listed, but yet here we are that they are extending their own ephemeral messaging policy here as well. So I can see that more and more companies outside financial services are also starting to hear the message or drink the Kool-Aid or whatever metaphor you want about ephemeral messaging.
I don't think it's drink the Kool-Aid, Matt. I think it's pay attention to what the DOJ is doing, because we speculated as to what the DOJ might do as we went through the SEC cases over the past, I would say, 18 months. And now I think this is the second FCPA case where the DOJ's specifically called this out. So I think that's going to be a pretty clear message that this is going to be important to the DOJ going forward as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Tom, now let me get to the weird part. This is the thing that I don't get with Gunvor, is that large amount of money, and here we have it, recidivist case, because Gunvor settled a bribery investigation and complaint with Swiss authorities in 2019 for bribery that happened in Africa in the early 2010s, an overlapping period with this conduct here that happened from, I think it was 2012 to 2020, but through most of the 2010s. And yet, Tom, they did not get a compliance monitor. And if you read through the settlement agreement, the logic is, according to the DOJ, that because the chief compliance officer will be making CCO certifications, the usual that we've talked about before, and the CEO and CFO of Gunvor also have to certify that, to the best of their knowledge, there are no other legal violations afoot. That is another standard sort of attestation that companies settling with the DOJ need to make. But because of those things, they don't get a monitor, even though this was a lot of money. This involved multiple executives at the company. This was their second recent FCPA or anti-bribery settlement, I should say, not just FCPA. And I'm not sure that I get how we arrive at no monitor there. That seems against the spirit of what I thought monitors were here for. And I've talked about this before. Is this really just a case of, we're not going to give you a monitor, so instead we're just going to give you a really big criminal penalty, which kind of sort of sounds to me like paying your way out of trouble as opposed to reforming your practices. Tom, what do you think?
So number one on the DOJ's list of criteria for monitorships is whether or not a company self-disclosed. And we don't have that here. And I'm going to take a deeper dive into that in a minute. They did not. And it appears in reading the settlement documents, Matt, that the compliance program has been implemented, but full testing has not occurred. The testing is ongoing, and that testing reports will be reported to the DOJ in the terms of annual reports leading up to the CO certification. So the second step or second question in the list of factors to get a monitor is whether or not you have implemented an effective compliance program and whether you fully tested it. So based on what the written requirements are, we don't seem to be moving towards that. Whether or not it is having a very heavy fine and penalty get you out of a monitor, well, that did not used to be the criteria. You could get a heavy fine and penalty and still sustain a monitor. At some point, I hope the Department of Justice either clarifies or issues new guidance or does something to really help us understand what is the DOJ's criteria, because it's not the company's criteria for getting a monitor. But we have not seen one for quite some time now, certainly in the FCPA world as well.
Well, I would just echo that. I hope the Justice Department steps forward and talks about this, because if they don't, the only ones left talking about it are people like you and me. And as intelligent and thoughtful as we are, in a vacuum, we are probably going to veer off to the cynical side. I certainly am. That this looks to me like a case that clearly should have received a monitor, and instead, the DOJ just decided to impose a big criminal penalty. For example, just a couple of years ago, when Fresenius had its big FCPA penalty, it was less than half of the amount that we are talking about here. They got a monitor. Why do we have a different result here? And we don't really have an answer to that from the DOJ. It is disappointing that we don't have the explanation. And absent the explanation, it's also just puzzling. I have no idea why they didn't, and it does not sit well with me.
So, Matt, the other component was, as you correctly noted, the prior corruption and legal violations Gunvar had involved in, particularly with those with the Swiss authority, all wrapped around culture. There was a paragraph on that, but really no indication of how that might have influenced the DOJ in an upward or downward amount of the sentencing. Any real thoughts on that area?
No, I mean, not specifically about that. I can say that the plea agreement that I have seen, and I haven't seen the whole thing yet, it does talk about how Gunvor had started at the base level was, I think, a $384 million penalty, which then got bumped up because of the severity of these issues, I think up to the 30th percentile. So whatever 38 times 3 is, it went up to that. But then they got a 25% discount for their extensive cooperation and remediation, which does count. It helps. But they didn't get anything for voluntary self-disclosure. So, you know, they go up 30%, but then down 25%, and that lands us at the $374 million fine or something to that effect. I'm not quite sure how all the math works out. But bottom line is, number one, yet again, we are reminded of just how much money you can save through voluntary self-disclosure. They probably would have gotten a fraction of the $374 million penalty that they ended with. Number two, you can still do an awful lot even then, but it is an awful lot of work that you need to do. And like you said, Tom, I hadn't even picked up on the point that they hadn't fully tested the program yet. It still seems to be remediation in progress. There's a lot of remediation going on across a lot of fronts. That's nice to see. I am also curious, as I said before, about the compensation policies that have been revisited and updated to incentivize compliance. I'm wondering if that is legalese for clawback provisions. Did they have them? Did they not? It didn't look like there were any clawbacks exercised here. I didn't see that word appear in any of the documents. So there's more that we can mine in this case for more insights. I think it's going to be worth at least another post on my blog, but there's an awful lot going on here that compliance officers would want to dive into.
So, Matt, let me take a stab at some of the numbers because I think it communicates once again from the Department of Justice how critical they view the act of self-disclosure. It starts with the culpability score under the U.S. sentencing guidelines. With cooperation and acceptance and self-disclosure, you can get a reduction of 5 points. Here, we only had cooperation and acceptance, so there was a dropping of 2 points. The total culpability score was 5. If there had been self-disclosure, that would have dropped it to 3. My back-of-the-envelope calculation on the base fine then drops the base fine to about 300 to 600 million range. If you took 30% of that, you're looking at a total criminal fine from the Department of Justice of somewhere between 190 million and perhaps as high as 300 million. So Gunvar was out literally millions and perhaps as much as 190 million for the simple fact that they did not self-disclose. So although it's a somewhat convoluted way of getting at it, I think the DOJ is communicating your fine and penalty will be significantly higher. Actually, it could have been even lower because if they'd gotten 50% off of the minimum base or if they'd gotten 75% because of non-egregious conduct, it could have dramatically, now that I say that, as low as 100 million. So the fine was significantly higher simply because there was no self-disclosure here.
And, you know, Tom, I should point out that at least I am not aware that we know how the Justice Department did hear about this case. But I am not up on all of my Latin America fraud and corrupt government regimes. So I would imagine if Petro Ecuador people are corrupt with one business, they might be corrupt with others. And, you know, maybe others are saying, oh, everybody's doing this. Don't you know that those Gunvor guys, they're doing it, too. There are multiple ways the Justice Department can hear about corruption that is happening within your enterprise, possibly even before you ever know about it. And if they hear about it first, then it doesn't matter if you voluntarily self-disclose. If they already know it, it doesn't count for anything. It just kind of underlines the more abstract point that the best way to stay ahead of this is not to do the corruption in the first place. There are a dozen different ways that once you start down that road, it can spin out of your control and wind up costing you a lot of money. Clearly, that is the case here with Gunvor, that it's costing them more than $500 million, and it's a painful lesson that they had to learn.
So we saw Vitol Trading let out on a FCPA case. That was Petro Ecuador. I think there were a couple before then that were much smaller. And I think the Department of Justice went to Petro Ecuador and said, tell us who your traders are. And yes, that was the start of it. And it's yet another reason, if you hear about someone in your industry having an FCPA violation, you better go look at your transactions and your business model with that client or that customer to see if you have problems as well. So, Matt, I was not sure how many lessons learned would come out of this case for this podcast, but it turns out there are quite a few.
There are indeed, Tom.
Well, Matt, till next time.
All right. Thank you.
This is Tom Fox again. As I mentioned at the start of this podcast, our sponsor for the Compliance Podcast Network this month is Ethico. Have you ever struggled with the ROI of your compliance program? Have you struggled with how to present your compliance program budget request to your chief financial officer? Well, I paired with Ethico to help you in both of those. Ethico has created an ROI compliance calculator, and I've written a white paper on the ROI of compliance. You can get those by going to the website listed on the show notes. I hope you will check it out. I hope you will use it, and I hope you'll let us know whether it helped you or not. I'd like to tell you about the newest addition to the Compliance Podcast Network, the Compliance Tip of the Day. In this, I give a quick 5-minute tip of the day that you can use for your compliance program going forward. Check it out on the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.